The Ballad of Ira Hayes told the story of Ira Hamilton Hayes, the Pima Indian who was one of the six American Marines photographed by Joe Rosenthal raising the American flag after the Battle of Iwo Jima. Though feted on his return home, as national interest waned and the speaking engagements and parades stopped, Hayes drifted into a life of poverty, jail, and alcoholism. When found dead from exposure in a cotton field on a Pima Indian reservation in Arizona in 1955, Ira Hayes was only 32. Lafarge's song pointed out the irony that despite the personal risks Hayes took for his country, he returned home only to find his tribe's ancestral land lacked adequate water, something which ultimately contributed to his death. The injustice of the tale moved Cash. "I loved it so much," he said of the song. "I had such a feeling for Ira Hayes. I'd been to the Apache country. I'd seen the old women carrying the big bundle of sticks on their backs for their night's firewood. I had seen the poverty and had a feeling for it." Cash liked the song immensely and decided to build a concept album around the Native American plight. In June, he recorded Drums and White Girl from Lafarge's 1961 debut album, and As Long as the Grass Shall Grow, itself the title of a 1940 book written by the senior Lafarge, and Custer from his most recent album. He added two of his own songs, Apache Tears and The Talking Leaves, and Johnny Horton's The Vanishing Race. Although the protest song had a long and healthy tradition in folk music circles, such social commentary never made its way into the politically conservative country scene. Native American land rights had yet to become a fashionable cause. Some country music critics thought Cash, by pushing the norms of the genre, was forgetting his humble roots. Others thought he had become tainted by left-wing radicalism. Because country music DJs refused to play the Ballad of Ira Hayes, Cash paid for a full-page ad and billboard that ran August 22nd, addressed to DJs, station managers, owners, etc. The ad asked, "Where are your guts? I'm not afraid to sing the hard, bitter lines that the son of Oliver Lafarge wrote. Classify me, categorize me, stifle me, but it won't work. I'm fighting no particular cause. If I did, it would soon make me a sluggard. For as time changes, I change. You're right. Teenage girls and Beatle record buyers don't want to hear this sad story of Ira Hayes, but who cries more easily and who always go to sad movies to cry. Teenage girls, regardless of the trade charts, the categorizing, classifying, and restrictions of airplay, this is not a country song, not as it is being sold. It is a fine reason, though, for the gutless to give it thumbs down. Ballad of Ira Hayes is strong medicine. So is Rochester, Harlem, Birmingham, and Vietnam." The next month, Cash's album of Indian songs, Bitter Tears, hit the market. Robert Shelton, the New York Times music critic who had given Bob Dylan his first rave review, greeted it as one of the best LPs to emerge from the 60s folk movement. The album may have alienated Cash from the Nashville scene, but it endeared him to bohemians, students, and intellectuals. Not a complete stranger to this group of fans, Cash had performed Big River, Folsom Prison Blues, I Still Miss Someone, Rock Island Line, I Walk the Line, The Ballad of Ira Hayes, Keep on the Sunny Side, and Bob Dylan's Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, to a crowd of 70,000 at the July 1964 Newport Folk Festival. Although Dylan once said that he first met Cash at the Gaslight, the two generally agreed that Newport was where they finally came face to face. Cash, the country legend with almost a decade of recording experience behind him, and Dylan, the young folk musician who was being hailed as the voice of a generation. Tony Glover, a longtime friend of Dylan's, later recalled the meeting. That night, Cash went on, and that was a groove. He came on like a king country stud, full of humble arrogance, and he lit the night with his own kind of charisma. Dylan came later, and instead of all the political material that everybody expected, he did songs from another side, like Ramona. You could tell the audience was puzzled, but they didn't want to be thought uncool by anybody, so they applauded just as vigorously anyhow. Later, in a motel full of people like Joan Baez, Sandy Bull, Jack Elliott, and some others, Dylan and Cass sat on the floor trading songs. Joan set up a portable machine, and that's where Bob gave Johnny It Ain't Me, Babe, and Mama, You've Been on My Mind. It Ain't Me, Babe also came from Dylan's soon-to-be-released Another Side. The demo of Mama, You've Been on My Mind had been made, but the song had not been recorded. Cash went on to record both songs along with Don't Think Twice, It's Alright for his Orange Blossom special album. The label released It Ain't Me, Babe as a single and advertised it as a new song from Bob Dylan on a new single sung by Johnny Cash. For Columbia, the championing of one of its new discoveries by one of its established artists provided great cross-publicity. Orange Blossom Special, Cash's most folk-inspired album, contained the three Dylan songs, as well as a version of the Carter family's Wildwood Flower, the classically constructed The Long Black Veil, the Irish ballad Danny Boy, the 1930s railroad song Orange Blossom Special, and his own protest song All of God's Children Ain't Free. By 1965, though his marriage was clearly over, Vivian refused to consider divorce because of her strict practice of Roman Catholicism. Cash believed in the family and extolled the virtue of hearth and home in his songs, yet he was no more than an infrequent guest in his own house. His children were growing up outside of his immediate care and control. He was torn because he felt that he had let everyone down. "He always came home eventually," says Roseanne. "He might be away for long periods and he might come back really messed up, but he would always come home and he would always try. When it was Christmas, he would bring back presents and leave footprints through the house so that we'd think Father Christmas had been through. He would get on a tractor and go around the acres of land that we had. He was doing stuff, but he was tortured beyond belief. Even as a little kid, I could look at him and see how tortured he was." To cope with the pain, Cash often drove deep into the desert, usually stoked up on beer, amphetamines, or a combination of both. His interest in the Old West had deepened, and he used these trips to commune with the cowboy ghosts, as he put it. Sometimes he'd even dress in antique Western clothes with a gun strapped to his leg and spend a few nights in an abandoned ranch near Maricopa, California, with nothing but candles for light and a wood-burning stove for heat, hoping to find inspiration. He had always enjoyed immersing himself in a subject, reading everything he could lay his hands on, contacting experts, and then projecting himself imaginatively into the situation or historical period. While planning Bitter Tears, he absorbed himself in Native American studies. Don Law had suggested Cash record an album of Western songs, so for Ballads of the True West, he investigated cowboys and pioneers. He read books by John Lomax, B.A. Bodkin, and J. Frank Dobie. Read back issues of True West magazine, looked up original newspaper accounts of outlaws and their crimes, and listened to taped interviews with the last of the original pioneers. He quizzed musical friends like Peter Lafarge, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, and Tex Ritter about the history of cowboy songs. To write a song about John Wesley Hardin, he read a manuscript of Hardin's original autobiography and, in the end, felt he knew Hardin as well as he knew himself. Explaining how he prepared for the album, Cash said, "I followed trails in my Jeep and on foot. I slept under mesquite bushes and in gullies. I heard the timber wolves, looked for golden nuggets in old creek beds, sat for hours beneath a manzanita bush in an ancient Indian burial ground, breathed the west wind and the tales it tells only to those who listen. I replaced a wooden grave marker of some man in Arizona who never made it. I walked across alkali flats where others had walked before me, but hadn't made it. I ate mesquite beans and squeezed the water from a barrel cactus. I was saved once by a forest ranger, lying flat on my face, starving. I learned how to throw a bowie knife and kill a jackrabbit at 40 yards, not for sport, but because I was hungry. I learned of the True West the hard way, a la 1965.